You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Bergamo.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se lo mangiano le femmine.
Where are we, Lionel? We're in Bergamo, Richard, a beautiful town in the heart of Lombardy.
It is beautiful. I was there quite recently for Il Lombardia, which started there last year. And it's, well, it's been in the news for much sadder reasons over recent months, hasn't it? But a regular stop on the Giro. We've been there many times over the years, haven't we, Daniel?
Yes, we have. And it's a symbolic city for Italian cycling. As mentioned recently in a recent podcast when we spoke to Marco Pinotti and Paola Santini of the clothing manufacturer Santini, there's a really strong tradition and culture of cycling in Bergamo. It really was the centre of the cycling universe up until not very long ago, and has been terribly affected by the coronavirus crisis. It's made the headlines around the world, hasn't it? And, you know, small villages close to Bergamo that previously, well, whose only claim to fame was really cycling. A place like Nembro, which we're going to talk about, was sort of base camp for the famous Selvino climb. It's on our route today, but we've seen Nembro, which is a tiny village, being mentioned on TV news in the UK, I'm sure in other countries as well.
Another place nearby is Ceni, of course, home to the Scuola Ciclismo Ceni, which we are raising money for through the sale of Stacey Snyder's cycling podcast Giro mugs and cappuccino sets. And if you're listening to this episode in very timely fashion, well, act quickly, because at 12:30 p.m. US East Coast time, that's 5:30 p.m. British Summer Time or 6:30 p.m. Central European Time, the second and final batch of mugs and cappuccino sets go on sale. Go to etsy.com/shop/Snyder Ceramics. Details in the episode notes. But the proceeds from the sales, all the profits from the sales of those mugs and cups go to the cycling school in Ceni near to Bergamo. And it was a good cause suggested to us by Marco Pinotti. Bergamo also the home of Felice Gimondi, wasn't it, who died last year, great Italian champ. We heard a bit about him from Sir Paul Smith in Sunday's episode.
And our
about
route
fashion.
Rich, today we'll be going through Sedrina, which is the village that Felice Gimondi was from, where his mother was a postwoman, I think she was the first woman in the village who had a bike, and she did her post rounds on the bike for years and years. I think she lived to the age of about 108 in the end.
And I should say a word, we just mentioned fashion there. Daniel, you're resplendent in your Mappe cap. A clue, perhaps, as the subject matter of today's episode. Lionel, any reason for your Kaz casket that you've got perched on your head there?
Not a Giro-related one, no. Just a Kaz cap.
Just felt like it.
What's your cap?
Have you ever Kaz? Have you ever had a...
I have, yeah.
Cass.
I have, yes.
A bitter Cass. Have you had that? I quite enjoy that. The red sort of... Well, you get a lot of similar drinks in Italy. Chinotto is a famous one, and Crodino. They're like a non-alcoholic tonic type drink.
During childhood trips to France and Spain and staying on campsites, I mean, just seeing an advertising board outside a cafe on a campsite for advertising Cass used to make my holiday. I'd rush in there with an old French franc coin and buy a can of Cass, and that would be me happy.
Little Lionel, very happy.
Happy as Lionel, I'd be with that. Yeah.
What have we got coming up today, Daniel?
Well, Rich, you alluded to the main feature of today's podcast, and we're going to be speaking to someone who made his name at the Mappe team, not me. We hear from me every day. I, of course, famously had a brief spell at Mappe in a fairly, you know, a fairly down-at-heel capacity. But we're going to be speaking to Luca Guercilena, who is the manager now of the Trek Segafredo team, and he cut his teeth at Mappe way back at the start of the millennium. And Luca is from, well, a place just to the west of Milan, where we would be staying tonight after the stage of Bergamo, because tomorrow's stage starts in Magenta, and that's just down the road from where Luca was born and still lives.
Whenever you hear Guercellena, do either of you, I always think of the Macarena. Hey, Guercellena. No?
Not really, no.
Tough roads in Lombardy. Can you give us a tale of the tappa, please, Lionel?
I can indeed. Yeah, we're going from Morbegno to Bergamo, 172.9 kilometres. The first big climb is over the Passo San Marco, but the one that we'll be riding, Richard, is the Selvino, as Daniel mentioned, reaches 948 metres. But it's famous for other reasons, isn't it, Daniel?
Well, it's famous in Giro history for Andy Hampstead winning a stage there in 1988. It's famous for Tony Rominger winning a time trial, a mountain time trial up the Selvino in 1995. And it's the sort of Alpe d'Huez of the Bergamo region. A lot of hairpins. It's actually quite a nice, easy climb, Napalm. I think it could suit you. You mentioned the first climb of the day, the Passo San Marco, a huge climb, which is not that well known, almost 2,000 metres altitude. I would recommend it to anyone who cycles in that, in the Bergamo region. Another one I would recommend, which is just slightly east of there, is the Passo del Vivione, again, not very well known, and the sort of dimensions of a real classic Giro or Tour de France type climb, very underrated.
Yeah, it's beautiful looking, the Selvino, isn't it? Particularly the aerial shots of the road kind of just draped across the hillside. Very nice indeed. Our route is 34.6 kilometres, and it's basically the climb and the descent of the Selvino. Not sure that we'll notice the hairpins too much on the RGT cycling platform, but here we go. Let's see how we're getting on the climb.
Well, I've crested the summit of the Selvino. Not sure, but nice and easy, Daniel. Didn't feel like that to my tired legs, but anyway, Bergamo's in my sights. If anybody would like an easier ride, 16 kilometres on Sunday for the final stage, Lionel and I will be riding that at 10 a.m. British summertime. Come and join us and wave as you ride past. As I mentioned earlier, the cappuccino cups and mugs made by Stacey Snyder go on sale today. They're raising money for the Scuola Ciclismo Ceni, and Daniel a day or so ago spoke to Edoardo Mafeis of the Scuola Ciclismo Ceni to find out a bit more about the club and what they're planning to do with all the money that we're raising through the sales of mugs and cappuccino sets and, of course, the wine from Divine Cellars.
Sì, allora Scuola Ciclismo Ceni ormai ha 25 anni circa di attività.
The Scuola Ciclismo Ceni has been going for 25 years now. We've had a few riders in our ranks who have gone on to turn pro. Andrea Di Corrado, who used to ride for Bardiani, was one, and Alessandro Bazzana, who was at United Healthcare for years, was another. This year we have 10 under 16s and 7 juniors or under 18s. We started the season with a nice training camp down in Sicily because we've got an affiliation with the team down there, but then, well, we all know what happened. Last Sunday was our first group ride with the boys again, all split into groups of three with one adult also riding in each group, and the groups 1 or 2 minutes apart so there'd be no dangerous gathering or standing around together. No doubt come the end of the season some of our sponsors will be looking at their investment and thinking they can't renew, given what they've all been through over the last few months. We're quite lucky though, in the sense that we've got lots of little sponsors rather than two or three big ones, and maybe that will make it easier to weather the storm. I should also add that the Italian Federation is trying to help out a bit. It seems as though they're going to waive the registration fees for teams in 2021, which helps to save a little bit. With the money raised by the Cycling Podcast listeners, we'd like to organise a couple of events, probably before the end of 2020. It looks as though normal road races will be hard to put on, so we're thinking of maybe a small circuit race, kind of kermesse around the village of Ceni. We can see the shoots of recovery in the region now. The numbers of contagions and deaths have gone down a lot, but you still sense the fear everywhere, which is hardly surprising given how hard we were hit. People are scared of a second wave. But yes, based on all of the numbers, we seem to be back on the right road again.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia. Brought to you by iWaka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
My name's Karen G and I am the Go Ride coordinator for the junior part of Kendall Cycle Club. So we've got a group called Bike Buddies, which is for the very young children, and they can start as soon as they're able to either ride a balance bike or a pedal bike. And then when they get to an age where they've started school and they've been at school for a couple of terms, they can move up into the more formal coaching, the Go Ride. And then we take them all the way through into their teenage years, really.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWaka. And as well as supporting us, the Cycling Podcast, they support the Kendall Cycle Club up there in the Lake District. They're very into their cycling, iWaka. A few days ago, we actually heard from, testimony from an iWaka customer, Mike Mooney, who runs Hub Velo in East London. And Theo Gegenhart, the Team Ineos rider, got in touch to say that he's a very good friend of Mike Mooney's. And in fact, Mike's business partner at the shop was Theo's teacher at primary school. A small world. And good to know that Theo's listening to our Giro coverage. That's nice. Hope you're enjoying it, Theo. Didn't actually say whether he was enjoying it or not, just that he was listening.
We take that as a given, surely.
Yeah.
Well, when we were in Bergamo, Daniel, in 2017, four things stick in my mind. One was a stage win for Bob Jungels. Two was seeing...
I'm surprised that all four weren't Food Lion. No. This is astonishing.
Hang on. We're building up to the important bit.
I'm surprised he's addressing this to me because I'm boycotting his coming sections from now on.
I'm dragging you back in. I'm bringing you back in, Daniel.
Incident, the Prince of Savoy. We promised that this Argiro, these Argiro podcasts were going to be a love letter to Italy. It's more like hate mail to hundreds of years of culinary tradition.
Trashed anyway, by the elephant of Watford.
Ruined by one teaspoon of garlic sauce with a lamb kebab last week. Dear me. I mean, am I ever going to live this down, or are you going to keep mentioning
it? Sure.
No. Anyway, so the four things I remember from Bergamo were Bob Jungels winning the stage, Moreno Argentine's time trial bike with a very curvy top tube was in a furniture shop window. We saw Felice Gimondi in the press room looking extremely dapper. And all afternoon, Daniel, you ran the advert that we were going to eat polenta in Bergamo, I think, or we were going to be heading to wherever we were staying in the Lombardy Plains. What went wrong was I didn't go wrong, did it? But we got invited to have a pizza with some colleagues, and we went for a fairly average pizza instead. And I missed out on polenta because I went home the following day. So for this installment of Il Ristorante, I ordered some polenta. I ordered some Tuscan sausages to go with it. I mean, I'm mixing my regions a bit here, but I made a nice sausage ragu. And
reminds me of a famous Tour de France story, Lionel. What's a Tuscan sausage?
Sausages from Tuscany. Oh, we'll do it. Have we time to tell that now? I remember.
I think we've told that. It's been told already.
It has been told. It will come up again, no doubt. Anyway, Felicity Cloak, award-winning food writer and columnist for The Guardian, has been running a forensic eye over my recipes, so let's hear what she made of my polenta e salsiccia.
Il ristorante.
It always makes me laugh that polenta has this reputation in the UK as being sort of very fancy, you know, chattering classes, Islington food, because actually it's basically like the Northern Italian equivalent of porridge. Here it's basically, you know, it's a staple crop that is cooked simply just with water. So if you're going to be really fancy about it, you can, I see, milk put in it. I've even seen it made with cream, but really you just want polenta, one part polenta to about three parts water. You need to get that water boiling before you add the polenta, and then you sprinkle it on top while stirring vigorously. And then you cook it really, really slowly because it turns very quickly from a pan of water with some dust in it to a bubbling, seething mass of lava that will spit scalding corn all over your tender hands. And ideally, you should cook it for up to an hour until it goes really thick and creamy. Italians really frown upon quick cook polenta. I do not frown upon it, I have to say. But I've had it I've had it a lot in mountain regions of Italy, actually, with sausages. It goes really well with, you know, proper meaty Italian sausages. It's also lovely with loads of, unsurprisingly, with loads of butter and cheese stirred into it. And then sometimes they then put it in the oven, really hot oven, with like an egg cracked on top of it and some speck sort of cured ham and more cheese. And it is just the nicest thing on a cold day. Yeah, I'm a very big fan of polenta. I'm very jealous that you're going to eat it because I've got none in my lockdown larder.
Polenta is very typical of the northeast of Italy in particular, and you get it a lot up in the mountains as well. And I thought that might have been a reference, what you were referring to with your sort of jagged peaks of cheese that were sticking out of the polenta. It's quite a striking presentation, a little bit sort of Dolomite-y with the cheese. It did look very nice. I couldn't really tell what was going on with the sausage ragu, because ragus have a tendency just to look like sauce. But I think this was the one that I would have liked to have eaten most. It looked delicious. You had a good consistency. The polenta, I think, should spread like lava on the plate, and it looked like yours had done that. Very impressive. I couldn't really find fault, annoyingly, with this one.
Oh, excellent. What's the secret to the polenta, what is it supposed to be like, the texture of it? Because it's kind of, people who criticise it as being bland and grainy, well, you can get over the blandness by just putting loads and loads of cheese and butter in it, but the graininess is part of its character. I mean, it's not supposed to be sort of whipped mashed potato smooth, is it?
No, it should have a certain coarseness to it, and that you can get very fine polenta, but I think that loses the charm. It becomes very pasty and sort of like gruel almost. I like a bit of texture to the polenta, but the secret is supposed to be that you cook it for, you know, an hour on end. It's very hot work. It's actually, when they're making large quantities, it's always seen as the strongest man in the household stirs the polenta. It's a real art, and they take it very seriously. I do prefer to take a few shortcuts and just add enormous amounts of butter and cheese, which gives the same creamy effect with slightly less in the way of muscular taxing. Patience is the secret, I would say.
Excellent.
Patience and fat.
Excellent. It's the key to most things.
Well, my mouth's sort of watering, Lionel. Polenta, it does look very... Your polenta looks very delicious. You always get a lot of polenta at the Giro, don't you, Daniel? Arguments between riders and... Little joke there. Polemica, polenta.
Oh, God, terrible.
Yeah, terrible. I think polenta... I think polenta's overrated.
Oh, no.
Discuss.
No, I don't think you've ever had... Well, one, you don't really care about food.
Daniel, I've eaten the best polenta in the best polenta restaurant in Bergamo, I'll have you know.
It's really? It's called Polenta. Polenta R Us.
Polenta, yeah. Polenta Express. No, it looks good, Napalm. Which flour did you... Did you use Grano Turco Turkish flour? There's always controversy about, you know, which polenta is the right, which flour is the right...
I used a polenta that I ordered from an Italian deli in London, in Soho, called Camisa's, and the label said it's from Lombardy. I mean, it's got the name of the region on the bag. It came in a very nice sort of cloth bag. Cooked well. It needed a lot of stirring.
One extraordinary piece of trivia that I learned the other day. Extraordinary and completely irrelevant and probably not worth mentioning, that so embedded is polenta in the culture in Bergamo that when they deal cards, so do people deal cards usually clockwise? Is that
I would say
conventional,
so, yeah.
Everywhere else,
yeah, unless they're doing it anti-clockwise.
Well, apparently in Bergamo you do it the other way because that's the way you stir the polenta.
Oh, wow. Do you know that in I've been reading about Gino Bartoli for a later episode this week, and do you know that in the 1940s there was a moral crusade against pasta in Italy, and it was believed that it caused skepticism, sloth and pessimism? At the same time, there was a lot... It was believed that cigarettes were the the kind of fuel of great athletes. Cigarettes were promoted among sports people quite widely.
Was the owner of Polenta R Us behind this anti-pasta crusade?
It was Polenta King. I've remembered the name of the restaurant now. Anyway, on with the bicycling. We're going to hear from.
Well, Rich,
yeah, sorry, Daniel.
As a non-fan, as a Polenta agnostic,
I mean, it's okay.
You'll be glad to know that we're leaving Polenta country and we're going to risotto country, because as soon as you get to the west side of Milan, where, well, Luca Guercilena is from, that's very much risotto country.
Well, as you say, Daniel, we're going to hear from Luca Guercilena, currently the manager at Trek Segafredo, but he's been around for quite a long time, involved in several different teams. You and he go back quite a long way. We'll hear about that later on in the interview. I know Luca Guercilena as the calmest man in professional cycling, having sat behind him on a flight from Bilbao to Milan a couple of years ago when we hit an air pocket, fell about 100 metres, it felt. There were screams, people were crying, mass panic broke out, and Guercilena was reading a book in front of me and didn't flinch at all. Cool as a cucumber.
Very calm, Rich, and I thought very appropriate for this episode and our Giro in general, because we're in Bergamo, we've mentioned the coronavirus epidemic and the effect, the ruinous effect that it's had in that region. But Luca, to me, symbolises to a certain extent the rebirth or the sort of green shoots in Italian cycling over the last 5 or 10 years, because Luca's quite an anomaly. He's quite unusual in the Italian cycling landscape, in the sense that he was not a professional cyclist. He's someone who went to university and studied and has a sports science and physiology background, and that always marked him out as someone quite different at a time, particularly going back 20 years when he started his career, when Italian teams dominated, but they were populated by old pros, former pros, and people who were very much part of the fabric and the furniture. But having said that, Rich, I didn't know too much about where Luca had come from, how he'd made his way into professional cycling, and that's how we started our conversation a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I grew up in Milano City. I moved here in Casinetta a bit later when I was married then. But okay, I mean, we're talking about 10 kilometer distance, so not that far. And my story is quite simple. I was grew up with my mom because my father died when I was 4 years old. And so I grew up with her. And we were just we two till I was 10 years old, when she get remarried. And let's say I have a normal childhood, nothing special. I was a typical Italian boy going to school and to church, and I grew up like this. Then my stepfather was a guy that loves sports, so he pushed me always to do any kind of sports, while my mom, she was very protective. So it was pretty, there were enough contrast on what to do. But okay, let's say, as all the parents say, school is school first, but my dad always says sports second. So I practice various kind of sports, from volley, from basket, and that's it. And then when I was 15, I went out for a ride with some friends, with a normal bike, with a city bike, and I enjoyed that much. And I knew that in the neighborhood there was a bike shop, and they have the owner of the shop has a cycling team for youth categories. So with my dad, we went there to ask if they were willing to have me. And and with the fact that I was living so close to the shop, then they say yes, because it was a really small team. And and I started there as a rider. And from that point, my cycling career was immediately giving me enough signal to let me understand that I was not a champion, you know. So
look, if we just if I just stop you there and we just go back a little bit. Your birth father, I think, were you 3 or 4, did you say, when he died? Yeah, three or four when he died. And was he a doctor or a nurse or a health worker?
No, he was an ambulance driver.
Okay.
And he was killed in an accident while he was driving with the ambulance, and was the typical story. Sometimes looks like a movie, but unlike is a reality. You know, that evening was not his shift, but a friend of him asked him to a substitution, and he went, and he was never back. And but that's life, you know. My mother teach me that for how much hard it is, you have never to look back, but look forward and live with a good memory of the people, and keep going. So for me, you know, my birth father was sort of a hero, because everybody, when all his friends and so on, they were all always talking about him like a hero, because he died while working in an ambulance, while helping people and so on. So it's been obviously this kind of image that I have. But then clearly when you grow up, you discover also that you can be a hero in a many different way. And for what's my childhood and so on, then, you know, I have a lot of love and respect for my mother that grew me up. She was 21 when she was a widow, and she grew me up by herself. And then even for my stepfather, that is younger than my mom, and he just came in our family, and he really did everything by himself to grow me up. And this is not that I say, but all my friends say that he's doing even more than a birth father. So I think I was being very lucky at the end in my life.
And so then, as you said, you sort of started off, you know, when you were about 15, to ride yourself. But just growing up, how aware were you of the Giro d'Italia and cycling? I know you're a football fan as well. I think you're a Milan fan.
Yeah.
But...
Yes. Yeah. I mean, living in Milan, sports is a part of life. So for sure, you need to be clear if you are a fan of Milan AC or Inter Milan. And I went for the first one, because when I was, 13 like this, when you really start to be involved in sports, was the time of the Milan AC of Van Basten, Gulli, Rijkaard, the Dutch trio. And so I went very often to the stadium to watch the matches and so on. And
so you were a glory hunter. You, that's what we,
yeah. Yes, on a way, yes. And that was really, really nice, a nice time. But I mean, in that was a nice time in Milano. I think that when I was a teenager, and even a bit later, Milano was a city that was growing very fast. We are talking about the 80s, 90s, and I love a lot that atmosphere, to feel the city moving, the city very active and kind of stuff, you know. And
Italy in general. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, it was a period when sort of Italy was at its peak, I suppose, economically.
Yeah. That was the peak. I think that we had some seasons in which we really grow up fast and good and well. Then obviously we have a slowdown, and in the last few years, also after 2015 with the Expo, I think Milan was back to growing up really, really fast. I consider Milan a really very nice city so far now, and so I think that's helped also me a lot in the way to be a bit ambitious, or looking to the future, knowing that you can chase your passion, you know, because I mean, it means to be lucky to live in a city like Milan, because it gives you all the tools you need to chase your passion. And as said, you know, I was studying, and then I race. And despite knowing that I was not a big champion, then I can chase my passion and focus myself more on studying, and after a point in sports science.
Okay, so this is the period of, this is the Pantani years. You know, yep. Italian cycling is having a bit of a golden age, certainly as far as, you know, if you're a teenager.
When I was racing the first two, let's say, the first race ever I've seen to get involved, let's say, was the World Championship of Fondriest in René, because I remember the scenario of the final that was very crazy. And then later on, in Italy, there was the dualism between Bugno and Chiappucci. And despite I was living very close to Gianni, then I was a fan of Chiappucci for many years.
Luca, what decided? I think I've written about this and asked people about this before, but I can't remember exactly, you know, what the conclusion was. But as far as you were concerned, what made someone? It's a bit like Milan and Inter, you know, it's not necessarily geographical. It's not, there's a bit of politics in there, but not always. There's a bit of religion in there. But as far as you are concerned, what made someone like Bugno rather than Chiappucci or the other way around?
There's everything. I think this, the most was the attitude to race. I mean, Gianni was more classy style, and you know, it doesn't speak that much. He's more a calm person, while Chiappucci was a very reactive, passionate, and he lost to attacks and so on. So there was always a bit the distinction between, let's say, a classy style and an aggressive style. So when you are young, probably you're more going to the aggressive style, while the elder people, they are more looking for the classy style of Gianni. It was more, let's call it as the more the attitude of a sir, you know.
Yeah.
But when you are young, you look more for the aggressive, the passion, just go all in without thinking that much. So I think that was a bit the reason why I was looking more for Chiappucci than Bugno at that time.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to Science in Sport, still powering me round Our Giro and supporting you, the listeners, with the code SISCP25, which will get you 25% off all your Science and Sport goodies at scienceandsport.com. That's SISCP25. Once again, I recommend the Energy Bakes, and I think the strawberry are my favourite flavour. I've got strawberry, lemon and orange here, and I've got fewest left of the strawberry, so that tells you that they're probably my favourite. And they're going to come in handy this week, Daniel, with a couple of extra long stages of our Giro. But anyway, we heard before the break there from Luca Guercilena talking about his background, I suppose. It was interesting to hear him talking about the Bugno Chiappucci years. You know, one of the great rivalries in Italian cycling, you know, of which there have been many over the years. I was quite surprised that he was a Chiappucci man because, as he said, Chiappucci was very emotional and impulsive, and Bugno seemed to be far more calculating and cool-headed. And as I said earlier, that's how I look at Guercilena, as quite a sort of cool customer rather than an impetuous character like Chiappucci was.
Yeah, and I was sort of prodding Rich, but I don't think there really is anything to this, or Luca couldn't quite give me the answer that I was looking for about you know, what determined whether someone was one or the other, Chiappucci or Bugno. And it is similar with a lot of Italian football teams. You know, sometimes there is a very strong religious subtext or political subtext, but sometimes there is not. And I think the main, as Luca hinted at there, the main thing that determined whether you were Chiappucci or Bugno was, well, it was a kind of emotional thing, but there was also an age element to it as well, sort of demographic element to it. I think the younger fans tended to be more attracted to Chiappucci. But as we heard Luca say there, Rich, he'd sort of given up on his dreams of becoming a professional cyclist quite early. He'd then gone on to, well, he started training as a coach and a physiologist, and he worked for junior teams, or he coached, took care of junior teams, under 23 teams. But he was about to get his big break and join the MAPE Talent Factory and encounter Aldo Sassi for the first time. Aldo Sassi later became famous as the coach of Cadel Evans, but he was also a very influential figure at MAPE. And he was also, as I mentioned about Luca at the start of the episode, he was an antidote to the sort of Michele Ferraris and these sort of notorious names that had been associated with great successes in Italian cycling, but also associated with some of the kind of shadier headlines around Italian cycling at that time. Aldo Sassi was, by reputation, quite different. And he found a bit of a kindred spirit in Luca. That's an interesting date, Luca, September 98, because I was about to ask you, as a young guy who'd studied sports science and, you know, was passionate about cycling and was innocent and, I suppose, you know, maybe naive, did you have any doubts about going into close contact with professional cycling? If we think about that time, you know, that's 2 months after the Festina scandal, and as far as most people were concerned, that was all professional cycling was. It was just doping.
Well, I have to tell that when I started to work with MAPE, the line of MAPE was very, very clear already. So I feel very protected despite whatever was going on in cycling, you know, because Aldo gave directly a line that being a coach or being a physical trainer has a certain ethics, and that was just to work on making people better and not affecting their health and stuff like this. So for sure it was a hard time. We knew that the medical side was having sort of dark influence on the sport, but for what was concerning me, I was very lucky because Aldo protected all of us and gave us a clear stamp as a just coach, nothing more than a coach. So we are talking about efforts and repetition and endurance and stuff like this, and not about other kind of stuff. And at that time, I was working for the most just with the young guys, you know. So we took like a mandate to start to teach the young generation to say that cycling is just pedaling on a bike and that's it, and try to start to make to make distance of what was the problem of cycling in that era. And I think that it took a while, but then we achieved it.
Well, it was 4 years from then until MAPE, until Dr. Squincy pulled out. But did you and Aldo and everyone there, and particularly the physiologists, particularly the sports scientists, feel more and more isolated over those 4 years in that line, in those ethics, in that philosophy? Because, you know, things didn't change in Italian cycling. And if whatever problems Italian cycling had over the next 15 years, you know, some of their roots, their origins were in the failure to listen and heed the messages that were coming at that time.
Yeah, I mean, for sure we felt that we were different, that's for sure. But simply because Mr. Squincy started to give clear lines on which were the range which we would like to work. So I personally can't say isolated. I think that was more affecting probably the riders. So we knew, I mean, there was a couple of situations with MAPE riders were feeling really isolated. But so far, for what was concerning us at the lab, especially we working with the young guys, we didn't feel isolated. And as I said, I think we were even more motivated because we thought we were going in a different direction, but that was the right direction. So let's say it was we were more in contrast on what was going to happen outside, you know, and as I said, we knew that was a slow mental set change, and it would have took years, but the feeling was that we were in the right direction. So that's why we never felt really isolated, because we have the big support from the owner of the team and of the lab, you know. So I think that if we talk about isolation, probably isolation is not the right word, but what I felt was more after 2002, when I started to work with Quickstep, and I was identified really as a sport director coach. And that was the first time that coach means coach.
And I was probably one of the first one that was not an ex-pro, you know. So there was more a situation in which you constantly need to explain what you was doing in that team. Because before was more the doctors taking care about physical preparation and coaching, while the figure of a guy that was just coaching and being sport director, so totally focused just on the pure performance, was something very new. And on that time, I feel more, I can't say he's isolated, but I don't know exactly how he's in English, but a white fly, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, a white fly. So that was even more that feeling.
And at Mappe, Luca, you ended up taking care of the, well, what was what they sort of called the young team, the third division team, the young group at the time, which has become sort of, well, very fondly remembered, especially by the riders who were part of that group, the Bernard Eisels, and Pippo Pozzato, and Cancellara. They still, you know, talk about it as the best years of their career in a lot of cases. And you know, we know a lot of those names. They went on to have great careers. Michael Rogers was another one. But there were a lot of guys who didn't have great careers, the Pavel Zerzans and Graziano Gasparre, people like that. If you look back now, if you know, I'd asked you in the first two or three months of that project, who was going to succeed, who was going to be a world star, and who was not going to succeed, how right would you have been in your predictions?
Well, I can say that from the two, from those groups, the two that for sure they have different qualities were Pozzato and Cancellara, because for the most they were, you know, where the psychological attitude that they had was a way different. They were really focusing on enjoying their life at the time, but in the meanwhile, you see that they were. Physically, they were champion, you know. So once their focus went more on from enjoying life to be a rider, I was almost sure that they would have been great, successful rider. Then there was another group of riders that was very strong. I mean, when I speak about especially Michael, Michael was already in a structure of the Australian Institute of Sport was well set up. So it was difficult at that time to predict how stronger he could have been because they have already big assistance. But so far, then he proved that he was also a great rider. For many others, I mean, you felt that they could have been having good careers, but you see that we're not going too far because of some of them as good physical data, but psychologically were pretty weak, you know. And some of them you see was adapting too fast to help the other instead of taking care about themselves for focusing on big results. And but so far I think that the project was good because in 2002 we have 40 riders. I think each of them win at least one race, and then we won 59 races in the season. Until March, we were the first team in the whole cycling ranking. You know, till that Milan-Sanremo gave too much point that we can't match it, but was a great experience because we have many victories and it proved that if you make good selection, then you are able to create the base for the first division team. And I think that was sort of a pilot study that then give the actual cycling.
And I think in 2001, around about 2001, you also tested a very promising British rider called Daniel Freiber. I think yeah, can you remember?
I remember testing you. Yes. Sure.
Yeah. I think
very, very promising, but I think that is wrong. It's like you're like my
the one
my
that
career,
got away.
You know?
Right.
Yeah, you identify immediately which were your limits, and finally you get on a direction linked to cycling, but not as a
But I think
it was a good choice.
I think you overlooked the fact, Luca, that I was overtrained that day. I remember when I did the test, and I think my VO2 max was, I can't remember whether it was 68 or something like that. But, you know, it could have been in the low 70s on a good day. I think you missed out. I think, you know, a future Grand Tour winner slipped through your fingers there.
Something happened.
Anyway, Luca, just to sum up the MAPEI period, I mean, obviously, in the last few months, we've had the very sad news that Dr. Squinzi and his wife both died in quick succession just a couple of months ago. But, you know, when I talk about MAPEI, and I was only there, you know, I was working in the company for a few months, and whenever I talk about it, I talk about the sort of level of integration of the company and the team, and how proud people who worked for the company were of the team. And you know, maybe because MAPEI was a company that made quite a product that wasn't very glamorous. And, you know, if you go to a dinner party and say you work for an adhesive company, the conversation maybe stops. But if everyone knows, you know, about the MAPEI cycling team, then it's a completely different conversation. What are the sort of the themes and things that you explain to people when you say MAPEI was kind of different and it was unusual and it was unique? How do you explain that to people?
Well, I think that in MAPEI we were proud to be part of the company, you know, and that was coming exactly from Mr. Squinzi and Mrs. Pazzoli, because the team was a strategy within the company. It was not just you know, having fun, giving your brand name to a cycling team, and that's it. You know, we were feeling part of a global picture in which, okay, we race, we give fun, we give emotion, we let know a brand, and at that time the company got benefits. So you feel part of a mechanism that was giving benefit to everybody in the company, and you feel very proud of that. And then you see the feeling that Mr. Squinzi has with the people, and how much he let you feel part of that project. And I think is a quality that just big leaders have. You was never having the feeling to be just someone, but you was feeling really a part of the group, of the company, you know. And I think if I analyze it now, I think that all the people that had worked for MAPEI, they have the same feeling. And I think that was coming exactly because Mr. Squinzi was a great leader, and he has a great group of managers picked up by him. And those managers were giving you all the tools to get, let's say, to develop your passion in a job, and having fun, but still giving you the possibility to progress and deliver what was really your 100% capacity. And I think that's why MAPEI is still a great company, and still all the people that were linked to that project, they're still feeling proud of that. On a way, I think that MAPEI really changed cycling because it was the first team probably really linked to a big company that used cycling to increase his market a lot, using cycling really as a strategy to build up the company. So I think it was a really has to be considered a flagship for cycling movement ever, I think.
And Dr. Squinzi, well, he takes the decision to leave in 2002, and you go on to Quickstep. I mean, over the next few years, I just want to sort of sum up. You as a coach and someone who, you know, knew the amateur scene in Italy and knew Italian cycling very well at that point. I mean, I see those next few years as the years when, although Italians were still winning, kind of underneath that was where Italian cycling started to go a bit wrong, you know, at the amateur level, and you know, all the problems that maybe we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years, that their sort of roots were in that decade, really. Would you agree with that? And if so, what exactly do you think was going wrong at that point?
Well, I think that when in 2003 I moved to Quickstep at the time, and called by Lefebvre and Crespi that were setting up the team. In Italy, that time was very complicated on the amateur side, simply because that's my belief. All the, let's call it the people that are working a bit in the dark pro cycling in the 90s, then they, due to the restriction and the rules and the new mental set that we start to born in the pro cycling, they moved down to the amateur cycling, and that was the big problem, you know, because then over there you find also, let's pass me the terms, a low cultural level. So it was easy for people promising you to win, very easy to get to attract riders, and that's create a big gap on what were the ideal scenario of a clean sport versus what was the reality in the young teams. But as I said, you know, it's correct. There was the roots started coming from very far, and it was a tough period because we need to change. But I think that the challenge was very deep, very, very hard. But at the end, I truly believe we succeeded, and I think that that was worth the effort. You know, you can suffer because maybe you change faster than others. But at the end, what is important that on long term, everything had a big change. And that happened also in the amateur cycling. It took a while. Sometimes you still now you find out someone that doesn't understand how it is. But I think that 99% everything got a big change. So that's the most important thing, I guess.
And of course, parallel to that, I mean, cycling was becoming more global anyway, so the Italian influence was kind of diluted, but also Italy as a country was maybe hit harder than other places by global recession, wasn't it?
Yes, for sure. I mean, in the moment we went global, even in Italy, the cycling culture is very deep. We were losing something, we were losing ground. I think all the others continent and country get adapted fast to what was cycling and find new resources, especially economical resources. And I think that then in 2008, when there was the big recession, yes, for sure Italian cycling lose a bit of a ground, especially in keeping active the Italian structures, you know, because I think that the Italian movement is alive because there's many riders, many staff, the sport director school is one of the best, and so on. But as well, I mean, one, you don't have any more the economical base to keep alive structure that can be easily identified as Italians, then you miss something, you know, because I always use this example to let understand people. I mean, when you are lost or at least you are sailing in a sea, and you need a lighthouse to refer to, you know. So even if you have many ships on sailing, but then you don't have a lighthouse to use as a reference, then it's very complicated that everybody go in the right direction. And I think that's what happened with Italian cycling at the end. We slowly lost power. Economical power, then we lost sport power, performance power, and at the end we are not able to set up anymore a big team that can be used as a reference for all the other, let's say, pro team or continental team or amateur teams. And that's, I think, is pity for a country that has cycling in his culture, as said, that gave the ball to Coppi, Bartali, and so on.
And as a coach, did you feel, especially when you went from Mappi to Quickstep, and you were, well, it was still a sort of half Italian environment, but you know, there was another culture as well, a Belgian culture. Did you also feel that you'd come from a country that was at the forefront in terms of training, methodology, physiology, that the Italians were slightly ahead?
Yes, absolutely. I remember that the difference between working with riders coming from Mapei versus riders coming from other teams, especially pure Belgians or let's say other countries in general, there was a huge difference. I mean, with us, there was the physiology analysis, the testing capacity, the really like the how to draft a training schedule was something really deep in our methodology. While in 2003, I still remember there was plenty of riders that were just still going on feelings, not even using heart rate monitor, something that in Italy was since years a must. And so there was a big difference, you know. And then you need, if you are a good coach, you need always to adapt on the rider you have in front. So with someone we were full deep in training schedule. With someone other, we were still discussing about how to use a heart rate monitor. And I think that was nice, was challenging, but I believe that we had a very good team over there, because there was all the heritage coming from Mapei team. And in the meanwhile, we were set up in the country that has cycling as a national sport. And I believe that Patrick and Alvaro at the time, they were able to really set up a very nice group of people that can really focus on the performance and on the victories, because there was a clear line that focused on the one-day race for the most, but the mentality was really to win each race in which we take part.
And you mentioned Lefebvre there, but the first time you become sort of your name, it becomes quite well known in the public, is obviously the Leopard Trek years, where the start of your process, start of the process which led to you becoming a team manager. But you'd come from Quickstep. I mean, how much had you learned from Lefebvre? Because in the space of a year or two, you were effectively in Lefebvre's position in a big team.
Well, I learned a lot from Patrick, because first, Patrick was the guy that gave me the opportunity to go with the junior team in Belgium when it was still, I think, 2000 or something like this, to make the Flanders Junior. So we selected young guys, went up there, and Patrick was on my side teaching me about what means to race on cobbles, on how to tell the riders what to do, and how to and consequently how to train people for those kind of classic. Then later on, when we worked together at Quickstep and he was the leader of the team, I think that the main lessons I got from him was, first, always get surrounded by good people that believe in your project. And this is something that now you find in the manual of leadership, but I remember that at that time he was already saying that the staff stay with you forever while the riders go in and out, you know.
That's one of his mottos, isn't it? He says yes. That a lot, yeah.
Yes, correct. And it's true. I mean, if you read the books written by big leaders of big company, they're all saying the same. Then another lesson that I always had with him is just to find out riders that are willing to progress, you know. You say the big champion is always helpful, but is a way better always to have a young guy that would like to move up, instead just focusing always on a big champion, you know. And I think that's also a very good lesson, and it's something that he's still going on doing, and it's unbelievable how they keep going scoring. And the third lesson is always that you have never to step back, you know, when you talk about whatever, starting from sponsorship to other kind of discussion, that if you really believe in something, you need to keep chasing it and not step back, not get destroyed by what is around, by radio tour voices or so on. Just focus on what you really need and try to get it. And that's why when I turned manager and at Track, then my first motto was go and take it, you know, because it was something that was coming from the heritage of Patrick. And and still, I believe him. I believe that he's one of the people that are key in my life, you know, because if I would have not met Patrick, even at Mapei time, I can say, as well as Aldo, for sure I was not in this position now.
Another thing that has always been a bit of a feature of Quickstep, Luke, is how international it's been. I mean, okay, it's got a Belgian soul and it's had a bit of half an Italian heart at times as well, but it has been very international. And if I think of your team throughout its you know, fairly long history now, almost a decade, national, and in the last 20 years or so, we've seen some teams that have really made that work. HTC were one that, you know, really made that work, and we've seen others where the lack of sort of a clear identity, whether it's a national identity or something else, it seemed from the outside to be a bit of a hindrance. I mean, how much where does that come from? Is that something that Trek want, that it's as international as possible, and how hard is that to deal with at times?
Well, for sure, the fact to be global and an international team, when we talk about the nationality represented, is coming from the sponsor. I mean, even at the time that I learned at the time of Mapei, in which, as I said, the team was really a marketing tool to promote the brand. And I think that in this case, what I learned at that time is very useful with Trek, that is a similar company. So global with you know, spots everywhere, and is present in so many continents and countries. So I think that that's for sure is coming from that. It's true that there's a pro and contra, even being an international team. You know, the good thing is that you are not stuck in a typical country mentality or national mentality, because when you have 75-80% of the people of the same country, then you can have some limit, because everybody thinks the same and you don't feel anymore the sparkling atmosphere when you have to deal with different mentalities. In the meanwhile, it's very good to be involved in a global team, because you can deal with different culture, different way to see the problems or find solutions and so on. But it's true that sometimes as well you miss kind of attitude in certain race that you leave it just if you are part of a country, you know. I mean, when there was Liquigas and there was Giro d'Italia and there were 85% were Italians, then you know that at the Giro that team was going to kick ass, you know, whatever was happening, but that was their must. As well as when with Quickstep we went to the Belgian races and we need almost to do trials to find out the eight riders at the start, you feel that was different. Being global, it's true that you're more attractive everywhere, but sometimes you miss that that kind of specific attitude. That said, I believe that when you have great rider, great leaders as riders, then everything go back in his place, because everybody's motivated despite the nationality to get the results. And I think that's the big effort we have always to do as team managers.
Amarcord, I remember.
No, non lo voglio vedere, sono facilmente impressionabile.
Ciao Ciro.
Hai rischiato di rovinare tutto con una vittoria.
Non so.
No, ma tornando seri.
No, dillo te, finché ci sono io.
Ma in inglese?
Sì.
So, dear listener, we are here in the bus with Filippo Pozzato. He tried to win today. He was not able to win, but for me it's the same. My love for you, for him, is the same, even bigger.
Thank you very much.
We better leave before there are kisses exchanged.
Grazie, Filippo.
Ciao. Mua. Mua. Grazie. Ciao.
Go Well, that was a day I remember very fondly, Daniel. Ciro and Pippo Pozzato. Pozzato went so close to winning that stage, got away on his own, and was caught by a sort of marauding bunch, or at least one or two were off the front. Roger Kluger won the stage for I Am Cycling. The day after, they announced they were pulling out of the sport altogether. But a great moment of, I don't know what we would call it, a moment where the caricature of Pozzato that Ciro has carefully cultivated almost met the
caricature of Ciro.
It was almost shattered, wasn't it?
But a caricature which is really in stark contrast to the image that Luca painted there, because, you know, I mentioned all the great, there's a panoply of young stars that Mappe had at that time, and Luca's quite adamant there that Pozzato was one of the most talented, if not the most talented, alongside Fabian Cancellara. And at the time when he was at Mappe, people predicted a glittering future for him. I mean, he went on to have a good career. Let's not forget that he did win Milan-San Remo, and he came close. He was on the podium in other monuments as well. So it wasn't all sort of clown shoes and, you know.
We've discussed before, haven't we? It's to his credit that he embraced that caricature in the last few years of his career.
Ciro and I have been speaking a lot about Pozzato recently because I think, as we've mentioned in the podcast recently, he's organising the Italian National Championships this year, which has been a bit of a movable feast because of the calendar changes, and I can't remember exactly when it's supposed to be now, but it's going to be in his home region. Of course, Ciro and I, we always used to refer to Pozzato, and still do, as il pavone di San Rigo, the peacock of San Rigo, which is where he's from. And we've taken to calling the Italian National Championships that he's organising as la grande pavonata. La pavonata would be like the peacock party, or the big peacock bake.
Meanwhile, the peacock of Coventry stands in stark contrast to Pozzato. Pozzato is somebody who didn't take himself too seriously as an athlete. As we heard in that clip there, Daniel, maybe you were somebody who took yourself a little bit too seriously as an athlete, or certainly.
I'm not sure about that.
Certainly.
There's always someone who says, "Oh, I was a bit overtrained on the day I did the test.
You were certainly
my shoes were too tight, or I brought the wrong arm warmers."
You were trying to encourage Guercellino there to say that you were the one that got away, but I thought he very subtly, very gently, very politely. Confirmed that you had definitely made the correct career choice.
Luca's let a few top riders slip through his fingers.
A few minnows slip through his net.
Bob Jungels, I see a lot of myself in Bob Jungels. he's another rider who so eluded Luca's grasp. So, he's got form, unfortunately. As much as I admire what he's done at Trek Segafredo. Trek Segafredo, incidentally, Rich, I should have mentioned this earlier, that the owner of the Segafredo company is currently marooned on his boat somewhere in the Polynesian islands, and he's been there for 3 months.
Wow. Probably out of coffee by now, is he?
He might well be.
On the
anyway,
team.
You were in the middle of insulting me.
No. That was fascinating to hear. On the team, the team have, I thought, started the season extremely well. Jasper Stuyven obviously won at Het Nieuwsblad. He looked very good. I thought Mads Pedersen looked extremely good, like he was, shaping up for bigger targets further down the road. Moschetti started with a couple of wins, then broke his leg, didn't he, and had a horrific injury. They've got Vincenzo Nibali now on the team, haven't they? They started the season looking pretty lively, I thought.
Yeah, they have. I think it's a team that has had a very international character, and this is something I've spoken to Luca about before, that brings advantages and disadvantages. One of the advantages is that you don't necessarily get cliques in the same way that you do at other teams, but at times the team can feel as though, or teams like that can feel as though, they lack a soul and they lack a strong identity and they lack a really sort of unifying, galvanizing force when, for example, they are doing the big races You know, for example, the Giro in Italy, they don't have a strong Italian core that sort of feels the race more keenly than an international team, same at the Belgian Classics. I mean, even their staff is incredibly international. They're director sportifs. They've got a Danish director sportif, a Dutch director sportif, French. And I think that's posed a bit of a challenge for them. But, you know, they've certainly... had some good riders over the last few years, and Luca has still got a very good grasp of where the talent is coming from, particularly in Italy. He's got a very good network, and he's a good talent spotter, I think.
Deserve a mention too for the women's team. Luca has sort of overall responsibility for that as well, and was very involved in setting it up, and they, I think it's fair to say, you know, after 1 year, sort of raised the bar a little bit in women's cycling, in the way that they're doing things and in the way they present themselves at races and so on. So that's been a positive addition. We're going to hear from Luca Guercellina again, but shall we hear from Ciro again first with the latest selection for his dream team?
Giro Dream Team with Ciro Scognamiglio.
Rider number four, dear listeners, Oscar Pereiro. For his victory at the Tour de France 2006 after Floyd Landis' disqualification. For my visit and his home in Vigo, Spain. For the fact that his apartment was really near the sea. And for the fact that when my interview ended, I spent all day at the beach. Thanks Oscar, to live near the sea and not on Passo San Pellegrino.
So only a couple of riders, is it two or three riders left? Two or three spots to fill on Ciro's dream team, Giro dream team. We've also got a team manager to come, I think, and a director sportif. How are we thinking that it's shaping up so far? Interesting mix of riders. I mean, we've had Pereiro, we've had Pret-a-Manger's David Miller, we've had Contador, Nibali,
Cavendish,
yeah.
Mark Cavendish, Pozzato, obviously, is there. Elia Radio Viviani. Yeah, it's an interesting, eclectic lineup, isn't it?
Hasn't really got anyone to fetch bottles yet, has he?
Mark Cavendish can do that on his day or not on his day, off his day.
Well, chaps, I didn't ask Luca Guercellina to name his Giro dream team, but I did think it would be interesting if we did a quick run through of some of the sort of hits and misses of his managerial and coaching career so far, spanning his MAPPA years to the present day at Trek Segafredo. Some obvious names and some slightly less obvious ones as well.
Isabelle Bettini si gioca questo mondiale, prova ad uscire Paolo Bettini al centro, Paolo Bettini al centro con Isabelle, è un testa a testa, l'Italiano vince, vince Paolo Bettini.
Hai visto?
Grandissimo.
From Paolo Bettini I can say that he was training more than the people thought, because everybody says Bettini is not training a lot. He loved to say that, because then the other competitors give him more chance, I guess. But I think Paolo was a great worker, and I think that his big power was really the mentality. I mean, the day you would like to win the race, you start to feel it since the morning. It was amazing, and we are close friends now. And I have to say that was the rider that teach me the most, than not me teaching him.
Et Luca Paolini, super petit renou avec la victoire. Luca Paolini, enfin vainqueur.
Oh, Luca Paolini was and is a super funny guy. At that time, he was a clear teammate, giving everything for everybody. But I believe he could have won a lot of more, because he has the capacity to win a lot of more. I think he's a guy that loves a lot to stay in a good company and enjoy people. And he prefer to help the others instead of being him in the front page.
C'è Petacchi con Bonne la ruota, Filippo Pozzato ancora qualche metro.
10 metri ancora.
Pozzato va a vincere. Pozzato su Petacchi.
Wow, that's been the one of the huge talent I work with, And I think for sure he has also won not enough for his capacity, but a lot is depending, because he's a very sensitive person despite what people think, and often he was too much involved in team situations in which he has not to, and instead to just focus into to race. But I believe he was one of the biggest talent I ever seen.
A 6 secondi è arrivato Schleck, quindi ne guadagna una trentina, considerato la buono.
Oh, Andy Schleck, I can easily say that he was just touched by God, and God told him, you will be a bike rider. Because I think when we speak about pure talent, I think Andy is one of the biggest ever, because he was able to make performance even without training that much, just because the engine was so big that that he can do everything. But as many times happen, when you are a big talent, then you have not maybe the full capacity to keep everything in your hands, and I think that's what was Andy. You know, he was so good, and everything comes so easy that then when he has to face difficulties, then was more in trouble than other riders that has less capacities.
I think he has. Horner's gone off and decided just to leave everybody else to play, including Vincenzo Nibali. This is Chris Horner reaching out for this crown.
Chris Horner, I think that we all agreed it was a great surprise to see him winning the Vuelta. Chris was and is a super funny guy, and is lovely to work with him. And in that Vuelta, I think that he was able to win it because for sure was a very strong rider, but especially because was underestimated from all the other great champions in that race, especially in the first 10 days. They gave him too much advantage without considering that there were not too much time trial, because it was an uphill time trial essentially. And Chris was coming from a very strong year, starting with the second place at Tirreno, and was the guy that was fresher than all the others because was not at the Tour de France. So I can say he was very strong. I can consider that we use a good strategy, and we had a lot of luck at that time.
Ganador, Julian Arredondo.
Julian Arredondo. It's difficult to analyze because he always claim health problem after his great season with us. At the moment, I thought he was lazy, but he's a person that is very difficult to define. I think he could have been really a new Purito Rodriguez, but probably he came at the point after many years struggling to have a, let's call it, a good life, in which he gave up, and then he was not able to perform anymore, and he has to quit.
And Bob Jungels has done it again. Another day in pink for him tomorrow. No one was going to deny Bob Jungels his moment.
Bob, I think he's a very strong rider, a talented rider, and I believe he can be one of the reference for the one-day race, while I don't believe he will be a GC rider, if not in a Grand Tour where there will be not too many top hill finish. It should be a Grand Tour that has many time trial and not long climb. But for one-day race, especially in the Ardennes, I truly believe that he can be a reference for many years.
I think jerseys are plenty in this Giro d'Italia for Alberto Contador. He took it very, very early on at Abetone, stage 5. He's only had one night where it hasn't been on the chair next to him.
A pure leader. I would have worked with Alberto 10 years because I never seen someone with such a leader capacity and able to pull out from his teammates 150% at each race, but delivering everything for the team and for the teammates. I was very surprised to discover that, and really pity I could have not worked with Alberto longer.
En dan komt Weiland
door de binnen. Of Brown. Brown in
gaat
midden.
Brown hier voor de verrassing zorgen of is het Weiland?
Weiland.
Brown.
Weiland.
Weiland.
Oh, that's yeah, that's a heartbreak memory. And was a lovely guy. I mean, we moved to Leopard Track together in 2011, and unlucky. I had to sign the paper that he was passed there on the road, and something I would have never think in my life to do that. I said, time is gentleman till to a point, because those are memories that you can never forget, and time by time is still very emotional when I think about that moment. And this poor guy, he's missed, you know, because he's was a guy at the top of his age and in the ramp to be a very good rider, and that crash blows him away, and it's really heartbreaking when I think about him, and was and still is a shock when I think about that day.
That was the life and times of Luca Guercellena, the boss at Trek Segafredo. And, well, I know you've known him for a long time, Daniel.
Yes, I have, Rich. And we should have said as well that this is a bit of a double header we've got coming up, because it's 10 years since midway through the 2010 season, behind the scenes at what was then, you know, by some people's reckoning, the best team in the world, Saxo Bank. There was a bit of a mutiny taking shape, and a lot of the best riders in that team, so the Schleck brothers, Cancellara and others, were plotting to leave Bjarne-Riis and join a new team, a Luxembourg based team, which was going to be called Leopard Trek, and one of the most influential figures, or one of the main figures in the management there, was going to be Luca Guercellena. And really, Trek Segafredo is sort of a continuation and an offshoot of that project. Luca went to that team, but the manager, the other figurehead of that team, was a gentleman by the name of Brian Neegaard. I cleared this with Brian before the episode today. He doesn't mind if we pronounce his name wrong, so we're gonna call him Brian Neegaard for the purposes of tomorrow's podcast. But Brian is going to be the subject, or the main feature, the main attraction of tomorrow's podcast, which is our wine stage. We're going from where are we going from? We're going from Magenta. There's a bit of a wine link, magenta. You know, you can have magenta sort of coloured, sort of, you know, magenta robe of a wine. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sort of red, isn't it? Reddish, isn't
ruby,
it? Sort of purplish
red.
Ruby, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's on that spectrum, isn't it?
We're going from Magenta to Barolo, through the hills, the Lange Hills in Piedmont, and we're going to be talking a lot about wine. And Brian is someone who is passionate about wine, and who is no longer working in cycling. He's working in the wine industry today, but we're going to have a nice catch-up with Brian tomorrow, hear about his time as a press officer, as a journalist, and now as a winemaker.
Indeed. Well, until tomorrow, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps. Se lo mangiano le femmine.